Romans chapter 3. There are some tapes back there on this chair. This is where we've been putting them. There is a tape. So there are some tapes back there. Check one for your name that you may have asked for last Sunday or whenever. Plus, there's two stacks of tapes entitled So Great a Salvation by Perez Reedhead. Everyone is free to take one for your own listening. I believe you will receive much from it. Let us read from chapter 3, verse 1 through verse 9. And would you stand with me as we read that, please? Ron, would you read that?
Yes.
Excuse me, just a moment. Teresa, would you move over and share Pat's Bible and let guy borrow yours?
Mm-hmm.
He has need of a Bible tonight.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Then what advantage has the Jew, or what is the benefit of circumcision? Great in every respect. First of all, that they were entrusted with the oracles of God. What then? If some did not believe, their unbelief will not nullify the faithfulness of God, will it? May it never be. Rather, let God be found true, though every man be found a liar. As it is written, that thou mightest be justified in thy words, and mightest prevail when thou art judged. But if our righteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? The God who inflicts wrath is not unrighteous, is he? I am speaking in human terms. May it never be. For otherwise, how will God judge the world? For through my lie, the truth of God abounded to his glory. Why am I also still being judged as a sinner? And why not say, as we are slanderously reported, and as some affirm that we say, let us do evil, that good may come. Their condemnation is just. What then? Are we better than they? Not at all. For we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin.
Amen. You may be seated. Ron, would you do me a favor and go out to the thermostat and just move it one line cooler? Whether you hear it come on or not, just move it one line cooler. Thank you. The tape by Paris Reed had entitled Ten Shekels and a Shirt. Starts off real slow, as you know. He starts reading his text. Someday I'll bring in a statement from him explaining the background of how he ended up bringing that message, and you'll appreciate that. He starts up real slow and he reads his text and makes a few introductory remarks, almost like, well, there's the matter of it. It's almost like he's concluded a public reading of the scriptures, and that's about all he has to say. And then he gets going and finally concludes with a great message of truth. Well, the book of Romans is kind of like that. You can get into chapter 4 and 5, and here's this proclamation of good news, and the propitiation that God sent forth in His Son, and faith of Abraham, and 5:1 says, therefore being justified by faith, we have peace with God, and all this is wonderful news. And 6 tells us that we no longer have to live in sin, and 7 demonstrates what it is to try to live by the law's motivation, and chapter 8 says we have therefore now no condemnation, and all this is wonderful. But starting off, chapters 1 and 2 into 3, kind of like an introduction that you just hope gets through pretty soon so you can get into the good stuff. At least that's somehow some people perceive Romans, the first 3 chapters. And the tendency of my mind had been that too, because I couldn't understand it, number one. Secondly, it only had one theme, and that is wrath. And that's not a lot of comfort when you're talking about the wrath of God for sin. You're talking about sin, you're talking about the law, you're talking about the wrath of God, you're talking about the judgment of God and the righteousness of God in His judgment. And you hear about that, and it takes time to really, as we have been going through this study, it takes time, week after week, to go through it and understand what He is saying And if you spend enough hours every week and enough weeks in a row going through it, the mind can have a tendency to just feel like, whoa, when can we get to the good news? But the good news isn't good news if you don't understand these chapters. It has been brought to my attention that there are some in the fellowship who the subject of the assurance of salvation is being agitated in conversation. And I attribute that, at least in part, to the fact that we're studying Romans chapter 1, chapter 2, and chapter 3. Because that is the very reason Paul wrote these things, is to agitate the question, are you really saved on God's terms? Do you have a basis to have any reason to have assurance that you are saved? Let's clear it up. Let's get down to the bottom of it. Let's set the groundwork and the understanding upon the basis upon which God is going to judge the world. Then we can have an understanding upon which the gospel stands as addressing the reasons that God will judge the world. And then we'll make sense out of this and give everybody a reason to have a hope if their faith is based upon the right object. Well, in doing so, Paul wades into chapter 1 and describes the state of a person in a society that's under his wrath. And he wades into chapter 2 and says, now look, at those of you who understand that these people deserve wrath, if you do the same thing, you deserve the same wrath. Then he reveals in chapter 2 that God is going to judge every man according to his deeds. To those who live to promote good, he will give them eternal life. If they do it perseveringly, that is, unbrokenly. That is, if they had never, as he lived according to selfish ambition and obeyed unrighteousness. But those who have lived selfishly and ambitiously and obeyed unrighteousness, God is going to give them, according to their deeds, what they deserve: wrath and indignation and distress and anguish. Whew. Now, Paul has a specific design in doing that, because by the time he gets to the 16th verse of chapter 2, Paul has laid down the fact that the Gentiles, all the nations of the world except the Jewish nation, have a law by which they will be judged. That is, in the workings of all minds, God has created the workings of law. That is, minds of all men perceive an obligation. It is an obligation present at all times, under all circumstances. It is law to that person. It is so pervasive in the minds of every man that all men agree on what justice and injustice is. Therefore, we can have governments, and we can have governments by law. We can have jury systems. We can have courts. Because every mind of man will understand and agree upon what justice is and injustice is. This is law, the workings of the law written upon every mind. So that, even if they've not had the law of Moses revealed to them, they have law imposed upon their understanding, and if they have broken that law in their own mind, their conscience will affirm so and convict them of their guilt, and God is going to use the same means of judging them. He will, on the day of judgment, reveal the secrets of men's heart by throwing light upon their minds, and all men will stand before God, and their own conscience will affirm, you did not love God, you did not love your neighbor, you were not a just person, you were an unjust person, you only sought your own good. They will stand condemned. Upon that basis, Paul continues and addresses the Jew. Chapter 2, verse 17. But if you bear the name of Jew... Now he's addressing the nation of Israel, the people in that nation, and he's going away from talking about all the other nations of the world. And he says, if you who bear the name Jew, and he goes on and describes those who bear the name Jew, they rely upon the law, they have the law of God revealed to them, and they rely upon it, and they're the teachers of the blind, teachers to the immature, they boast in the law, and they boast in knowing God's will, and they prove the things that are essential. They are a corrector of the foolish, a teacher of the immature. He says, you who are a Jew and have all these things, when you teach others, do you teach yourself? When you preach that you should not steal, do you steal? And he's applying the same principle to the Jews. You who Jews who have this great and large knowledge, the revealed will of God and law of God, do you, like the Gentiles, know how others should live and teach so, but you yourself do not live that way? If you teach other people, because of your great revelation, you should not steal, and yet steal, are you any different, is what he's saying in principle. Are you any different than the Gentiles who know that others should not do things and yet do it themselves? So, you who have the law are no better off in terms of relationship to law than the Gentiles who do not have the law, but only the workings of law written in their hearts. Why are you no better off in relationship to law? Because law that you do understand, you do not live by. So he concludes at the end of chapter 2 that, look, even though you have physically been circumcised, because you do not adhere to a law that you have been that has been revealed to you, you are no different than the Gentile who does not live according to the law that his mind understands. So that God is going to treat your circumcision as if it were uncircumcision if you have not obeyed the law. And he says, won't God look at the Gentile who does not have the law but simply law written in his mind? If he lives according to all the requirements of law, will not God count his uncircumcision as circumcision? You assume the answer is yes. In fact, he says that the uncircumcised person who keeps the requirements of the law, if he does that, will judge the Jew who is circumcised but does not obey the law. So he even puts the Jew as being the object and to be judged by in relationship to the uncircumcised person who has kept the requirements of the law. Now understand, we are not talking here about the gospel and how to be saved. The gospel doesn't come in until nearly the end of chapter 3. He is not talking about how to get saved. He is telling you and describing to you and I how people end up being lost. He is not talking about Gentiles who have violated their law and violated their conscience. If they will turn around and start obeying their conscience, that they will be saved even though they violated it before. He's not saying that at all. He's not saying, you Jews, because you have violated the law of Moses, if you'll just stop violating the law of Moses and go back to obeying the law, you'll be saved. No. He is laying out for us the understanding that in the relationship to law, if you have not conformed your life to it, in relationship to law, you have lost all hope of justification before God, whether Jew or Gentile. So, he brings the Jew and the Gentile down to the same level playing field, as we say in our vernacular of this day, and at the end of chapter 2. And chapter 3 begins with Paul supposing, as he often does, like in chapter 6, supposing objections that he's going to hear from those that he's writing to. Not hear necessarily in writing to him, but in their own mind. This is going to come to their mind as they read this thing, particularly Jews he's writing to. And the first objection or question they're going to have, like an objection is, a Jew would say, after hearing what Paul just ended in chapter 2, a Jew would say, well then, what's the advantage of being a Jew? Paul? I mean, if we're going to be treated just like the Gentiles are going to be treated like we are, and we're going to be treated like the Gentiles are, and that our Jewishness doesn't matter, then what's the advantage of being a Jew? And what does he say? Ron?
Great in every respect.
Great in every respect. What's the benefit of being a Jew? What's the advantage of being circumcised? Paul says, well, there's great in every respect. First of all, now you might think Paul's going to go first of all, second, third, fourth, fifth, because he says there's a great deal of advantages. But that's not what the first of all here means. It doesn't mean first out of many that he's going to name, but he says, considering all of the great advantages and benefits of being a Jew, the most important, the first in importance, is that what? Keith?
You're
given the oracles of God. The first, the highest benefit, advantage of being a Jew is that they had been given or entrusted to them the oracles of God. It wasn't that they just got them. Paul is saying that God entrusted them to them. God gave it to them, confided in them to keep and to safeguard His Word. Particularly, also His promises. They were revealed through the Jews, and He entrusted them, He placed in confidence to them to keep them, to not let them become destroyed and God not have a voice and a known revelation in this world. There is in Greece a place called Delphi. And there's there what is called the Oracle of Delphi. You may or may not have heard of it in history. It's called the Navel of the World. Mythology says they let two ravens go and they flew around the world and they met at Delphi, which meant it was halfway around the world in both cases. So it was the Navel of the World. And I visited there because I was very curious about it. And it surprised me because it was out in the middle of nowhere, standing in as a very small, almost city, very small, just mountains all the way around. And it was about a 2-hour bus ride to there. Now this oracle had, when one of the mystery religions, it had a like an underground place, and a priestess would be under there. She was called the oracle, as well as what she spoke was called the oracle. And she would become sort of an altered state of consciousness through smoking of burning types of materials or taking of various drugs, things like that. And she would be getting this altered state of consciousness somewhat. And people would come and ask her questions, kind of like, you know, 1-800-PSYCHIC. What's going to happen in my future? Tell me, what should I do about this? Same thing that goes on in our astrology charts and psychics and all that. You know, what's the future hold? And of course, the answers were given were always rather vague, subject to interpretation. One very famous case is the king who came to this oracle and said, I plan to go to battle against a certain country. Will I be successful? The oracle inside mumbled a while and finally said, if you attack this other country, you will destroy a nation. So he attacked the other country and it turned out to be his own. He lost. But the oracle didn't lie because he destroyed his own nation. He did destroy a nation. So this is a very famous oracle in old times, and this was a common practice that there was places known as oracles. People would go asking about their future. However, the only reliable oracles, words from God, were in the possession of the Jews. The only true and living God, the creator of all things, had spoken only to one people, to the Jews. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1, God who in different times and sundry manner spoke unto our fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by His Son. That's an accounting of the fact that God had spoken. This is what oracles means, speakings. And God had spoken only through the Jews and entrusted them to hold on to these words and not let them perish from the earth. And they had a great advantage because they had the revelation of God's will, God's promises. What could be more beneficial than that? What could be more advantageous than that? Secondly, Paul answers by saying great in every respect. Then another objection comes to the mind of the Jews. What then? They had these promises. These Jews had these promises. What then? If some did not believe, their unbelief will not nullify the faithfulness of God, will it? The person objecting is contemplating the possibility that what Paul said in the second chapter is true. He knew it to be true. That there were those who had the law that taught others they should not steal, but they themselves stole. They preached that you should not commit adultery, yet they committed adultery. Jesus very clearly revealed the hypocrisy of the nation as a whole and its leadership, the Pharisees and their hypocrisy. Beware of the teaching of the Pharisees. It's hypocrisy. Called it leaven. Do what they say, but don't do what they do. Why? Because they do teach people not to steal, even though they do steal. So Jesus clearly revealed the heart of these Jews. So if some did not believe, which is another translation is if some were unfaithful to the word that they received. Their unbelief will not nullify the faithfulness of God, will it? As I pointed out Sunday morning, unbelief, unfaithfulness in man does not destroy. The faithfulness of God does not change him from being faithful to His Word. God is not faithful to people. He is faithful to Himself. If you had to depend upon God to be faithful to you because of you, you'd have no basis to really trust Him. But being faithful to Himself gives certainty, certain reason to trust Him. So unbelief by some is conceded in as evidence in their disobedience. But implied in this question is, aren't the Jews chosen? Aren't they the elect? Has not God destined to blessedness the Jews because of God's promise made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Is not God going to save every Jew even if every Jew does not obey the law? Is the question. Is God's promise to save the elect, to save Abraham and his seed as He promised Abraham, is that going to be set aside because the Jews are unfaithful to God and to His law? Wow. Now we're getting into the thick of it. Has the sins of some caused God to back out of His promises made to Abraham? Because the Jews believe that they are going to be saved because they're Jews. They had a belief in eternal security. As long as you were born physically a Jew, you would be in the kingdom under the reign of the Messiah forever and ever in a state of blessedness, and you would see God. And the only condition was to be a physical Jew. So the issue of this whole issue of election is raised, which Paul addresses in chapter 9 and chapter 11 in the very same book, but he addresses it later in its proper place. But the issue that is raised here is, aren't the Jews destined to be saved, every one of them, as decreed or promised by God? Is the eternal security of Jews threatened by their disobedience to God? Won't God's faithfulness override their unfaithfulness? What is not taken into account here is that the Jews neglected, willfully or ignorantly, the conditions of the promise. God's promises are conditional. They looked at it as unconditional promises. That it didn't matter whether they kept the law or not, kept the covenant or not, God would unilaterally save every Jew. Jews still believe that today. Being a Jew is sufficient to be saved, a physical Jew. And Paul had just demonstrated in the last of chapter 2 that a Jew is not one who is one outwardly, but one who is one inwardly. So, Paul answers in verse 4. Paul answers the question in verse 3. If some did not believe or were not faithful, will their unfaithfulness or unbelief nullify the faithfulness of God? His answer is, never. May it never be. God forbid. Put aside the thought that God's faithfulness can be overturned by the unfaithfulness of man. Put that side of thought. Put that side away. That thought away. He doesn't even deal with the issue of election. He'll deal with that later. What he's dealing with is God faithful to His Word? And he says, rather than think that God will stop being faithful because man is unfaithful, rather than that, let us think that let God be true, so every man be found to be a liar. Paul is addressing the idea that God will stop being faithful under any conditions by saying, let every idea of man be found to be a lie if it ever concludes in the notion that God is unfaithful, that God is not true. Now, I have said it before in a different manner, but Paul is saying exactly the same thing. I'm not crediting myself for Paul's statement, just the other way around. Paul has declared it a long time ago. The character of God is the basis of sound doctrine, true doctrine. The veracity of God. Veracity is that characteristic of a person that they keep their word. They are true to their word. They are a person of truth. The veracity of God stands when all other ideas come up against it, and the veracity of God is threatened to have to be moved. If that is the case, then let those ideas fall by the wayside. Let them be considered lies. It doesn't matter, folks, how coherent, profound, cute, exciting, stimulating, comforting a theology may be. If God is portrayed as having a character that is not righteous, that is not true, then that idea must go. If the view of God's character is such that He is viewed as not being true, not being faithful to Himself and to His Word, if His character is brought into disrepute, then the idea that led to that has to be thrown out. It doesn't matter if it's Augustine, it doesn't matter if it's Calvin, it doesn't matter if it's Luther, it doesn't matter if it's Finney, or Wesley, or Carroll, or yours. If your notion that you entertain and allow your mind to accept bring the God's character, His faithfulness, into question, you've got to throw out those notions. Got to. I don't care what kind of song you hear, how popular the singer may be in Christian circles. I don't care who's on the radio and how cute it sounds and how wonderful it sounds, how clever it sounds and all that. If you end up through that influence believing that God is not righteous and God is not true, that His character is not pure, is not holy, you've got to throw that out. I don't care if it costs you hundreds of dollars for the music or hundreds of dollars for the books or whatever. You must not submit yourself to that influence. It is His character that must stand if everyone else goes to hell. Or that God be considered as not true and unfaithful. And let everybody go to hell. And look what he does. He now quotes from the Old Testament. Paul just said the greatest advantage that the Jews had was their oracles. Now he quotes from their oracles. Okay? As it is written, as a backup to what his statement is, that let God be true and every man is a liar, he says, as it is written in your oracles, those that came from God, those the source of truth, as it is written, that thou, meaning God, mightest be justified in thy words and mightest prevail when thou art judged. You know who he's quoting? This is wonderful. He's quoting David. The oracles that the Jews had received, whom they quoted and listened to and looked to have spoken from God, It was either Moses or David. And if there's anybody that was a prefigurement of the Messiah, it's David, because the Messiah is the son of David. And he brings to the forefront David, the great king of Israel, whose son, the promised one to sit upon his throne forever, the Messiah, who was to come and who is Jesus that has come. He brings him forward to testify regarding the fact that let God be true and every man a liar when he says that thou mightest be justified in thy words and mightest prevail when thou art judged. The word prevail means overcome. The idea is a picture in a courtroom. Here's a person accused of being a criminal. If you will, being unfaithful. If you will, being a liar. He's accused of that. And when the court proceedings all are presented and all the evidence is presented, the person overcomes all of the accusations and prevails. And David says that thou mightest be justified in thy words and that thou mightest overcome when thou art judged. When somebody, when the world looks upon you and passes judgment upon you and tries to pass judgment upon you for not being righteous, God, may you overcome. May you overcome and prove that everyone else who calls you unrighteous is a liar. That's the sense that Paul is saying that he derives from what David himself was saying. Look at the first part of that. That thou mightest be justified in thy words, your oracles, what you say. Here's the kicker. You know when David said those words? They're recorded in the 51st Psalm. The 51st Psalm is the great prayer of repentance to God immediately after Nathan the prophet had come to him and said, Thou art the man who deserves the judgment you have just pronounced. And David, instead of justifying himself, says, oh, that thou mightest be justified in the word you have just sent to me. I receive your words as true, O Lord, that you may be justified in thy words and that you may prevail when you are judged. David had the very spirit of the whole matter when he himself knew. When God speaks, he himself had to bow down before those words because God is true. And every man who challenges God and tries to judge God as being unrighteous is a liar. What a time to speak those words. What a significant time to utter those words, that thou mayest be justified in thy words. I learned something about justification, justifying oneself. When you are right in something and falsely accused, there's no reason, excuse me, when you are wrong or right and falsely accused, there's no reason to justify yourself. If you've done what is right before God, there's no need to justify yourself. And if you've been wrong, there's no reason to justify yourself. Self-justification has no place in either case. If you're wrong, don't justify it, confess it. If you've done that which is right and other people don't understand or accuse you of being wrong, there's no need to justify yourself. If before God you've done that which is right. So David says that you may be justified, Lord, in the words that you've just spoken to me through Nathan your prophet. Let God be true and every man a liar. God's veracity, folks, is a first truth. Greg?
What about Paul when he, for the truth's sake, seems to defend himself? Is that because it's for the truth's sake? Is an apostle going to defend himself? And
he is establishing his authority for the sake of establishing the gospel. He's not establishing a personal justification. Huh? God's veracity is a first truth. Nobody believes that God lies. Nobody. Paul is simply stating something that every mind that is listening to him and reading him would agree to intuitively. People do not believe that God lies. What they question is, has he spoken? They know God will not lie. They may refuse to believe what he says, but that is suppressing the knowledge of the truth. But if you ask in the abstract, does God lie? No. But when it comes to what he promises and what he says, they refuse to believe him willfully because they suppress the truth. But the question is, has God spoken? If people will accept Jesus Christ as the Word of God, they cannot disbelieve what he says unless they refuse to have an honest mind. The veracity of God is a first truth. If God speaks, he will not tell a lie. And that's what Paul is appealing to, among other things, as well as their own oracles that they had. Objection 3, verse 5. Objection that might be in the mind of those who are reading. But my prayer is that we will see in what Paul is doing the connection between what he has said and what he will come to say. But if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? The God who inflicts wrath is not unrighteous, is he? Now, Paul just said that God is true. And the person might be objecting, saying, okay, now if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? Another way of saying the question after that, the God who inflicts wrath is not unrighteous, is he? The question could be asked, will God inflict wrath if he is righteous? If in verse 3 some did not believe God and were unfaithful to God's commands, does that nullify God's faithfulness? No. So now he comes down to here and says in verse 5, now if our unfaithfulness, our unrighteousness that we acknowledge, that you described, makes his faithfulness, his righteousness stand out, and that the very occasion for his righteousness to stand out is our unrighteousness, is God going to inflict wrath upon those who are the means for his righteousness to be shown? Is God unrighteous to the point that he will inflict wrath upon those whose unrighteousness is the occasion for God's righteousness to be seen? Will God punish the men who are the very means of bringing him glory? You see what he's trying to say? Is that righteous? Why? Here's the Jews and their unfaithfulness over the years, and their disobedience has been the very occasion, Paul, for the righteousness of God to have a means by which to demonstrate itself. Is God going to be so unrighteous that he's going to pour out his wrath upon the very instrument and the means by which he was able to glorify himself? That's a powerful question. Let's go back to Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve in the garden. All the blessings, all the benefits and advantages of being created, not in sin, but created in communion with God and in His favor. You see it? See the parallel? Jews said, what's the advantage of the Jew? Well, you've got the oracles of God. Let's go back to Adam and Eve. They had great benefits and advantages of being created in communion with God, in His garden, in His favor, and they sinned. Is God unrighteous to have punished them, since in their sinning was the occasion for Him to promise a deliverer, a savior from sin, and their sinning gave Him the opportunity to show His graciousness by not destroying them utterly, but by graciously providing skins to cover the nakedness and their shame, to actually slay an animal and shed blood so that they may be covered? Look how gracious God is in doing that. Is He righteous in destroying them when only in their sin can we see His grace and mercy? Why, Paul, is God going to be so unrighteous as to destroy the Jews who are the very ones who can allow His mercy and grace to be demonstrated? Then he says, what shall we say then? It's almost like, what shall we say then? Shall we dare say what the conclusion would be from this? That God would be unrighteous to inflict wrath upon those who were the means of Him receiving glory? Let me ask you two questions. Did Adam's sin show God's character? Did Adam sinning show God's character? As a result of Adam's sin, was God's character manifest? Not in his sin, but Adam sinned, and then God's next action, did it show God's character? As he acted towards Adam after Adam sinned, not in the sin, but as God came walking in the cool of the day and what happened thereafter, did it demonstrate the character of God? Yes. The question again, did Adam's sin show God's character? In that connection, it did. Let me ask you a question that sounds very close to the first one. Did Adam sin to show God's character? No. Isn't there a big difference? Did Israel sin to show God's character? No. Does Israel's disobedience bring about a revelation of God's character? Yes. What's the difference? The tendency of sin is destruction, misery. It demands God's righteous judgment. There is no tendency to glorify God in sin. Nevertheless, God in that circumstance, working simply as God, it always demonstrates what He is. It would almost be like saying, because man sinned, it generated within God a part of His character that He didn't have before. It's almost like what this objection is saying. Look, folks, God is a pure, holy God. When He makes Adam, it reveals one thing about His character. When He treats Adam after Adam's sin, it reveals another thing about God's character. That character is always there. It just shows various aspects of it in different circumstances. There's no glory in the sin simply because afterward God begins to reveal a different part of His character than He did before. No thanks to the sin. In spite of the sin, God overrules it and manifests a different aspect of His character. There's no glory to the sin, nor the sinner. So does God unjustly, unrighteously inflict wrath upon those who are the occasion for His glory? Look at the answer. May it never be. May it never be. What's His answer? For otherwise, how will God judge the world? How can any person judge another if they are not righteous themselves? Number one. But even more so, the Jews assumed. It was not a matter of dispute with the Jews. They assumed that God was going to judge the world. You remember Abraham talking with God in the form of those visitors that came by his tent on their way to Sodom and Gomorrah? And they said, we're going to go down and destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham says, wait a minute. Are you going to treat the righteous and the unrighteous the same way? What if you find 50 righteous people there? Will you withhold your judgment for 50 righteous? Yes. Well, certainly for 5 you're not going to destroy a city. If you just find 45, he goes on and bargains with the man for a while. In this discussion with God, in this circumstance, he says, shall not the judge of all the world do right? As far back as Abraham, it was assumed by all the Jews that God was going to judge the world. So, with that assumption that God was going to judge the world, there was the assumption that he had to be righteous. To assume that God would be unrighteous and yet judge the world would be to assume that judgment itself would be faulty. There would not be a true judgment. That there would be people who were innocent that would be found guilty and vice versa if he was not a righteous judge. That he could be bribed if he was not a righteous judge. So the Jews assumed that God was going to judge the world, and Paul takes that very assumption that he was going to judge the world and say, how could he judge the world if he judged unrighteously as you suppose in your objection and inflict wrath upon those who sinned, but as a consequence he demonstrated and brought glory to himself in the occasion of their disobedience? No, God is righteous, as you know, because he's going to judge the world. So you know he's going to be a righteous judge. And your question, supposing he will be unrighteous and inflicting wrath upon those who sinned, cannot stand up. And they had to accept that. They themselves already assumed he was a righteous judge. Yet their question assumed that he might be unrighteous. Next aspect of this verse is, how will God, if unrighteous, judge the world if judgment demands righteousness in the judge? A couple hard sentences. If the heathen are judged by God and are condemned and sent to punishment for their sin, although they did not hear the gospel, is God unrighteous? You know the old question. It's the same asked in a different way. If the heathen are judged by God and are condemned and sent to punishment for their sin, although they did not hear of the gospel, is God unrighteous in condemning them? God forbid that God is an unrighteous judge. May it never be. Look, here's what the Jew is trying to say. Look at Paul. Through the disobedience and unfaithfulness of the Jews as a nation, God is going to be greatly glorified when he saves the Jews, because he promised to. Because the judge of the world is going to receive such glory out of our disobedience, certainly that ought to influence the judgment he passes upon us. And Paul comes back, and truth comes back and says, no, the sentence passed upon the criminal is based upon what the criminal deserves, not the notoriety or the praise the judge may receive in being a righteous judge. There may be cases where somebody of great notoriety is tried and the judge handles it so well and so balanced and so righteous, and all the evidence is treated so correctly and all the sentences are pronounced so correctly and the instructions given so righteously, that when it's all over, everyone stands back and admires the decision that's passed down because the judge ruled so well. And because he ruled so well, he's very shortly appointed and passed to the Supreme Court, and is given great honor and great respect. Because he is elevated so high in society, does that mean that his judgment upon the person that he tried should have been different? Because he received such great glory and honor out of it? Not at all. He would be an unrighteous judge if, out of what he was going to receive, out of this fine judgment that he's making, he were to let the person have a less sentence than he deserved. That would turn right back around upon that judge, and people would say, terrible judge, unrighteous judge. To give leniency to the person simply because he was getting praise out of being such a fine judge, they would scoff at him, and he would no longer be considered a fine, righteous judge. So, he says to Israel, just because God will receive glory by saving those whom he saves, you get no credit out of it because of your disobedience that necessitated this plan of salvation in this new covenant. If God condemned, here's a question that we've entertained lately. If God condemned Tyre and Sidon and sent them to hell, even though they would have repented had they seen the miracles of Jesus that Capernaum saw, is God unrighteous? May it never be. May it never be. But if through my lie, my unfaithfulness, the truth of God abounded to his glory, why am I also still being judged as a sinner? Similar question with a different twist to it. Instead of my unrighteousness, now it's my lie. And instead of his righteousness, it's his truth. But if through my lie, the truth of God abounds to his glory, why am I still being judged as a sinner? Here's the point. If through my lies, God is glorified, and a person who is righteous glorifies God in all that he does, if through my lie he gets glory, am I still a sinner? Kind of twisted thinking, isn't it? You know, this directly addresses the question, does the end justify the means? Directly addresses that question. Does the end justify the means? Can lies be a means, a justifiable means, if in the end God gets glory? Not at all. Not at all. We could not rent the new arena over in Anaheim, advertise in the paper, I get up there and preach, we have 5,000 people show up, and when I get ready to invite people to come and repent of their sin and indicate publicly their repentance of sin and their trust in the mercy of God, we could not have various people planted to stand up and come forward one at a time to kind of inspire others to do so. We could not use deceptive means to preach the gospel or to bring people to salvation. That is not acceptable. Because becoming converted is to begin to live by the truth, to have an honest heart. And to use dishonest means and have a dishonest heart and use deceitful means to say, well, it's justified because we're trying to get people saved, is a very, very contradiction, a definite contradiction. The end does not justify the means. The end does not baptize the means. Not at all. And Paul, that's what's being said here. Doesn't the end that is occurring, doesn't the end that God gets glorified baptize my lies? That's the question. No, because the tendency of sin is destruction and misery and falsehood and deceit and darkness, emptiness, and the wrath of God. Sin cannot be used as a means to glorify God. But But the Jew was thinking that the disobedience of Israel, the unfaithfulness of Israel, so created a situation that when God promised to restore Israel and give David fulfillment of his promise and make a new covenant, why, look, we had a hand in that. So as a result, verse 8, and why not say, look, if you're going to take that stand, he says, verse 7, if you take that stand that lying is a justifiable means because the end is that God gets glory, then why don't we just say this? And some people say we say this, he says. Let us just do evil that good may come. If doing evil brings good, let's do more evil that more good will come. So why don't we say that? And the mind of the Jew would be shocked to see the consequence of his thinking, the implication of his thinking. I think it was just last week we were talking about the idea that some people have a difficulty sorting out. The idea is that the heathen who has never heard about the gospel, it is unfair, unjust for God to condemn him simply because he disobeys the light that he has. Until they hear the gospel, they don't there's no sufficient reason why for God to condemn them. And I stated something to the effect that if that was true, that a person did not sin sufficiently without hearing the gospel to deserve condemnation, then we ought to burn all Bibles and kill all the missionaries and keep these people from going out there, because every time somebody hears the gospel and rejects it, then they qualify to go to hell. But if they don't qualify to go to hell until they hear the gospel and reject it, let's destroy the Christian church, and everybody who doesn't hear will go to heaven. And our minds get shocked at that, and they should, because that is the ultimate implication of the idea. And so too the Jews. They're thinking of, well, we are the cause of God getting glory. Our unfaithfulness is the cause of God getting glory. We shouldn't be condemned for that. Why, our lives lead to His glory. Why are we considered sinners? And Paul comes right back and says, look in the mirror and see what you're saying. What you're saying is, let's just sin more. The good more, good will come. Like 6:1, Romans 6:1. Shall we sin that grace may abound? God forbid on that too. Just because the grace have abounded, because your sin abounded, doesn't mean you're to sin more that grace may abound. Your sin only necessitated a great sacrifice on the part of God. It did not bring about His glory. The tendency of your sin is destruction, not the glory of God. God worked over your sin for His glory. The very workings of God, as seen by man, glorify Him, in spite of what he has to deal with. As it is seen, whatever he does in regards to man, he gets glorified in it because it just shows his character. But the tendency of sin does not have the tendency to glorify God. God deals with sin and rebellion in such a way, because of his character, that he gets glory out of it. Look, when Adam and Eve were walking in the garden, fellowshipping with God, communing with God, they had the blessedness of communion, they had the blessedness of his favor. And God received glory when his newly created beings continued to walk in obedience, continued to trust him, continued to love him. He received glory. What a wonderful glory God gets when moral beings voluntarily love Him and trust Him. What does that say of His character? Oh, He's trustworthy. You see a child who is so submitted to his father's wishes and will and loves his dad. What does that say about the dad? Paul says the glory of a man is what? His wife. You look at somebody's wife. If you see character in that wife, if you see benevolence in that wife, if you see real affection towards her husband, real submission towards her husband, the greatest thing about her husband is her. Paul says the glory of a man is his wife. The greatest thing about a man is his wife. God got glory when Adam and Eve walked with Him, trusted Him, loved Him, obeyed Him. When they disobeyed, when they stopped trusting Him, when they stopped loving Him, He had to deal with it. They no longer had the blessedness of their obedience. They did have the blessedness of undeserved favor and mercy. But they didn't have the blessedness of perpetual, persevering obedience and love. God receives great glory out of people loving Him and persevering and being faithful. God receives a different kind of glory when that same person, they do not love Him and trust Him, stands before Him in judgment and is a righteous judge, sends them to eternal punishment. He receives a different kind of glory. He will receive the glory and praise of a righteous judge. He'll receive glory, but as a righteous judge. To those who love Him and serve Him and trust Him, He will receive the glory, but a different form of glory, a glory for a different reason. He will receive the glory as one who is trustworthy, that secured the trust and love of an individual voluntarily. So God receives glory, but no credit to the sinner. He'll receive the glory as a righteous judge. So, listen, Jews, be shocked with this, and they were, I'm sure. What you're saying is this: let's do more evil that more good may come. Now, professing Christians would never say that, but they live that way. They live in a rather strange way of thinking that their unrighteousness commends the righteousness of God, therefore they're bringing glory to God through their unrighteousness. A particular theological view holds the idea that God's glory and righteousness is greatly manifested through saving disobedient people. Not saving people out of disobedience, but saving people who remain disobedient. Isn't that greater honor to God? That He would be more gracious to save people who never really obeyed Him? So they could never take any credit to themselves that because of their obedience, God saved them? And they talk, and they live, and they hold a theological view that just like Paul is addressing here. Why? God saving me is a greater glory to Him because I don't have anything to boast of. I wasn't obedient, I didn't love Him, I didn't trust Him. But He's going to save me. Oh, that really glorifies God and His grace, doesn't it? Mm. It never will be that way. Mm. But that's what's said. They wouldn't quite say it like this, but that's the bottom line of what they're saying, folks. Now, to those of our day, to those of the professing church for centuries has believed that and promoted that in one form or another, in glorifying the grace of God by allegedly saving those who never do repent and never do trust Him and never do love Him. And to the Jews that he was writing to, he's trying to demonstrate through the folly of the implications of what they're saying, to demonstrate and show them, look, do not, you cannot, look what you're saying. Let's do more evil that good may come. And what Paul is doing is this. He's demonstrating to the Jews on the basis of law they've lost all hope. They had the law. They had the oracles. Their election and promises of God. God stands by His promises, but they're conditional. God is not going to save Jews just because they're natural Jews. Nobody can plead their unrighteousness as a cause for God to save them or not condemn them simply because God has devised a means by which He will be glorified in spite of their sin. And above all, let God be found true, that every man be found a liar. When God speaks, that's the end of it. That is the truth. And it doesn't matter what we say. And he addresses their very own oracles to demonstrate what God says is true. It doesn't matter what they believed. Remember the time Jesus was talking with the nation of Israel and the people? He said to them, anybody that sins is a slave of sin. And they said, we have never been slaves to anybody. They forgot Egypt. They forgot Babylon. They forgot the Chaldeans. They forgot the Romans. They had forgotten. Or they just ignored it. The same kind of thinking brings them into darkness, into thinking. It doesn't matter if we've been slaves. God's going to get more glory out of saving people who don't trust Him and love Him than people who do. Terrible, terrible thinking. Paul says, may it never be. Otherwise, how can God judge the world? Now, when he says the world here, they assumed he was going to judge the world. To them, the world was the Gentiles. Surely God's going to judge the Gentiles and condemn them all. Because they have not been called. They have not been chosen. They're not descendants of Abraham. So God's going to judge them all. But he's not going to judge us like he judges them. And Paul is saying, wait a minute. Wait a minute. If God judges the world, will he not be a righteous judge? Yes. Will God exclude you? No. You have broken the law that you knew. The Gentiles have broken the law that they knew. You are both in the same state before the judge of the world. You have both violated known law. So then he says, verse 9, in concluding these objections. What then? Are we better than they? This is the end of side 1. Side 2 now begins. And he demonstrates that they're both in the same state before the righteous judge. On the basis of law, they have lost all hope. He has demonstrated since the beginning of chapter 1 up to this point, he has demonstrated that they are unrighteous. He has demonstrated that they might argue their unrighteousness should not be counted unrighteousness because it's brought glory to God in some strange manner. But he has drawn from them the acknowledgement and confession that they are unrighteousness and unfaithful. Well, what does that mean then? He has drawn out of them the confession that they did live a lie and that they have been unfaithful, though we shouldn't be counted against us. He's drawn out of them the confession that they've been unfaithful to their law. They have broken the covenant. What does that mean? When God judges the world, it includes the nation of Israel. It includes the Jew. Their own strange thinking and that their sin brings glory to God. Therefore, it can't not be counted as sin. No, no, no. You've already confessed sin, and the righteous judge will consider it sin as well. So then, are we the Jews better than they in relationship to God, in relationship to the law? No. No. Not at all. For we have already charged, from 118 onward, that both Jews and Greeks, which are Gentiles, are all under sin. Here is the conclusion of the matter that he began to develop in 118, particularly in 2:1 and onward, that both Jew and Greeks are all under sin. All have sinned. All are sinners. Why? Because Adam sinned and passed on his nature? No. Because Adam sinned and was removed from man a righteousness and therefore he was void of righteousness and his nature was changed? No. Are all under sin because of the children of Adam? No. All are under sin because they have not lived up to the law written in their minds or revealed through Moses. And then he reverts right back to their oracles and says, as it is written. And Paul goes from the beginning through all of the scriptures. He takes some scriptures out of the law. He takes some scriptures out of the prophets. He takes some scriptures out of the mouth of David. Over a long period of history of the Jews, of Israel, and place after place after place, God's oracles pronounces the fact that at that particular time, and another particular time, and another particular time, there is none righteous, not even one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks for God. He's talking about the Jews. This is the oracle of God to the nation of Israel. This is not the words of Paul to the Gentiles. This is not the gospel to just the Gentiles. This is not revealed to Paul to bring about the fact of the revelation that the Gentiles are under sin. He is quoting from the Old Testament and through various prophets and through the King of David that at various times in Israel, God pinpoints Israel and says, there is none who seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become useless. That word together speaks of unity. As a unified people, all together, all united, they have become useless. There is none who does good. There's not even one. How? The throat is an open grave. With their tongues they keep deceiving. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their paths. The path of peace have they not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Jeremiah chapter 5. Jeremiah chapter 5. Jeremiah and Ezekiel were the two last prophets to Israel just before God completely destroyed Jerusalem and Judah and what was left of Israel, and it was ended as a nation. He destroyed them for their idolatry. Their sin had become beyond pardon. And the righteous judge would no longer be righteous if he continued to overlook their sin. In Jeremiah chapter 5, as he's in Jerusalem, God says to Jeremiah, who is going to soon destroy Jerusalem, he says to Jeremiah, roam to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem, and look now, and take note, and seek in her open squares. If you can find a man, if there is one who does justice, who seeks truth, then I will pardon her. There is none righteous, no, not one. Paul is not quoting this to try to prove that all are under sin. Paul is addressing the very words out of the prophets and the oracles of God that the Jews had to demonstrate that the Jews, the proof that the Jews have violated God's law, and that the very words of God pronounce the fact that in relationship to law, Israel has forfeited the favor of God. Their transgression of the law, their unrighteousness as a people, have forfeited forever their claim to have the favor of God based upon law. Before God, Israel cannot claim to be justified before God on the basis of law. He is bringing the Jewish mind up short. He's trying to awaken it to see that in their own history, they have violated God's law. So they cannot stand before God and say, God, we're justified before you because we have always kept your law. No. He is demonstrating that that claim is forever shattered. Now, verse 19. Now we know, and all Jews know this, now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God, because by the works of law, the thee should not be there, because by the works of law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, for through law comes the knowledge of sin. Since Paul has finally brought about conclusive proof that the Jews as well as the Gentiles before law have no claim to be justified before God, then he can rightly say, by works of law, no flesh will be justified in his sight. What did we find in chapter 2 earlier? Verse 13, for not the hearers of law are just before God, but the doers of law will be justified. He's not talking about how to get saved. He is describing there that if those who persevered in doing good and always did good and never stopped doing good, then their deeds of law will justify them because they would never have sinned. But now he gets over to where we are in 3:20, and in the interim between those verses, he has proved that both Gentile and Jew have not obeyed law known to them. So they have forfeited any way to be justified before God by law. So now he can say to those who are in this state of unrighteousness, by the works of law, no flesh who has broken law will be justified in his sight. For through law comes what? Knowledge of sin. Through law comes knowledge of sin. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under law. Jews, you had the oracles. They were given to you. You were under its jurisdiction. Now these words speak to you, Jews. The words that I just quoted, from verse 10 through 18, Paul says, the words that I've just said to you from your own words, from your own law, they speak to you who are under it. And they speak and demonstrate that you as a people have all lost all claims by law to stand before God and claim to be justified. See what Paul's doing? Paul has demonstrated that the Jews have lost claim to be justified on the basis of keeping law. He has drawn out of them through these various arguments, confessions, that they have lied. They have been unfaithful. They didn't matter to them they'd been unfaithful because they thought they would be saved because they were Jews. So in this arrogance, in this false doctrine, they readily admit their unfaithfulness. Paul demonstrates that unfaithfulness now will bring them without hope before law, on the basis of law, they have no hope to be justified before God. Now, Paul will begin for the first time to talk about how someone can be saved. People will study chapters 1, 2, and 3 that we've been studying and think that, and hear that we might be saying, well, how did the person get saved? Well, if you keep the law forever, you'll get saved. That's not what Paul says, and that's not what we're saying. We're not saying if you love God supremely after you've been a sinner, you'll be saved. No. The obligation to love God exists whether you are a sinner or not. If you've been a sinner, you're obligated to love God whether there's any mercy for you. Whether there's any grace for the sinner. The sinner is obligated to love God. It's not a commercial transaction. If you'll save me, God, I'll love you. That's a business deal. God, if you save me, I'll love you. God, if you save me, I'll believe you. God, if you save me, I'll trust you. God, if you save me, I'll tithe. God, if you save me, I'll obey. No! Man owes God his allegiance, his love, his trust, even if there was no mercy and grace that God has designed and brought about. If Jesus had never come and died on the cross to secure an atonement and a covering for sin, we still owe God our love and our trust. If God made no promise, if there was no heaven after we lived,
we still owe God our love and our trust. If there was no hell, we still owe God our love and our trust while we lived here. We owe it to Him. Not for what we get in return, it's just our obligation. So when we talk about law, people say that's legalism. They don't understand law at all. We talk about loving God, oh, that's just legal. That's just works. What Paul is demonstrating is you have not kept the law from the first till now. You have forfeited all right under law, under any kind of obedience, to be justified by law. If you as a Jew had 1 year where you disobeyed the law, and after that you came back and kept the law from then on, that 1 year disqualifies you from being justified by law. If you did it for 6 months, if you did it for 1 month, if you did it for 1 week, if you disobeyed the law for 1 day, you forfeited the right and the claim to be justified before God by means of law. Forfeited. In the state of one who has broken God's law, thereafter, by works of law, no flesh will be justified in His sight. Now, once he's concluded that, once he's concluded both Jew and Greek all under sin, he now begins, but now apart from law. That's what he's been dealing with for two chapters. Law as a basis of obligation, and violated the law as a basis of condemnation. And now he says, but now apart from law, since law has lost its ability to justify you, there's nobody in the world who can be justified by law who has once violated it. And he has demonstrated the Jews and Gentiles have violated it. So now, apart from law, righteousness of God has been manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. Paul starts off on another direction. He's built up to where the Jew and Gentile must conclude that by means of law, they cannot be justified before God. And Paul begins to say something else has been revealed, manifested. Not only in verse 118, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. Now Paul says, now apart from law, the righteousness of God has been manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. Paul says there's two things that's been revealed. Wrath of God and the righteousness of God. A righteousness of God. God's righteousness. God's righteous character has been manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. The law and the prophets. Remember the first chapter? That this is a gospel of God concerning His Son, which He promised beforehand through His prophets in the Holy Scriptures. This gospel now that He starts to talk about. He hadn't talked about the gospel except in the introduction. Now He begins to talk about the gospel. Now He begins to say that the very thing that the prophets witnessed to, the very thing that the law witnessed to, has now been manifested. God's righteousness. We're going to stop right there. That's where Paul brings his readers to. Our non-Jewish minds do not nearly catch the impact of what Paul has done to the Jewish mind. Really don't. Perhaps we could get a taste of it if we were to say to all you Calvinists out there who believe that you're going to be saved because God has chosen you to be saved regardless of your own personal faith, to all of you who believe that regardless of your disobedience, your unfaithfulness to God, God is going to save you because He decided to save you, not because you will believe the gospel or love Him or trust Him. And if you were people who believed that whole doctrinal view, and I could demonstrate to you that that is a bunch of rubbish, and your confidence in the election of God as described in those terms was built on a false foundation that demonstrated that God is an unrighteous judge, you would be shocked. Your whole hope of salvation would be utterly destroyed in a moment. Well, that's what Paul has done to the Jews. Their whole hope as a nation for being saved by the Messiah had been shattered by the time he got to where we are. Because they had different ears than you have. They had a whole different set of understanding about the law and their hope of the law and their hope in their election and their hope in their physical descendancy from Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. They depended upon their physical genealogy for their salvation. They could prove that they went clear back to Abraham. That was their salvation. We have Abraham as our father. Jesus said, no, you don't. Your father is the devil. Do you know that the Jews today still look for the Messiah to come? Did you know that the Messiah is going to be of the lineage of David? Did you know two books in the New Testament, two of the Gospels, describe the lineage of both Mary and Joseph and take the lineage back through David to demonstrate that Jesus is the son of David? Right? Maybe you didn't know this. In AD 70, when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem and the temple, all the genealogical roles were destroyed. There's no way to prove any Jew is a descendant of David. None whatsoever. They were all destroyed. There's no Jew that can prove he is a son of David, son of Abraham today.
God doesn't want anything
to He doesn't have that to hope to base his hope on anymore. Because he can't prove he's the son of David, son of Abraham. In Israel, they're trying to find people with the last name of Cohen. Cohen is a word, I think that means priest? King? It's a Jewish name, I think, that is an indicative that you're of the tribe of Levi. I think it means priest, I'm not sure. But they go around the world looking for people with the last name of Cohen. And accepting that last, having that last name as an evidence that you're of the tribe of Levi that can serve in the temple. Can't prove they are. They've lost all connection. And Paul graciously labors, to pull away the self-deception of the Jews. To take the veil that's over their eyes and to bring Christ so that it can remove the veil. Tries to jerk them out of their self-deception in depending upon their lineage, their heritage, and even their sin as a proof that they'll be saved. That God's faithfulness is so set, and it is. He will save us because we sin, which will demonstrate His grace and glory so much. That was the Jewish thinking. And Paul so graciously, and the Holy Spirit so graciously, moves upon Paul to write in such a way as that the Jew would see that before the law, Israel as a nation long ago had forfeited claims of being justified by law. That David and Moses and the prophets all said various times in different ways, there's none righteous. No, not one. If you can find one, Jeremiah, in the city of Jerusalem, I'll pardon her, where there's none. What's the application for ourselves, folks? The application for ourselves is, for those of us who have sinned, we have forever forfeited any ability to offer up works of law to justify ourselves before God. That's it. No works. As a means to be justified before God and avoid condemnation can be offered up because our right to do that has been forfeited by our sin. We can't prepare ourselves. We can't prepare our hearts in any manner to come before God as a basis upon which to be justified. We can't prepare our hearts for a day or a week or a month. We can't prepare our studies. We can't prepare our doctrinal views to get them correct and right with the motive that when once we get it all together, this is some reason for God to justify us that didn't exist before. If the mind contemplates that there's some type of preparation that the heart's got to go through, and at some point in time this preparation will form a complete picture upon which now God will treat them differently than he would before, then one is seeking to be justified by law. So this today is the day of salvation. Why? Because a righteousness of God apart from law has been revealed. A righteousness based upon promise and grace and the atonement of Jesus. An acceptance by God of the sinner apart from law, but based on grace. Based upon a promise. And that's what Paul is doing. He can't get into all of that until he brings the Jew and the Gentile to see. They're going to look to the law. They have already there's no reason to look to law. Lost. Hopeless. The knowledge that one is sinned, the knowledge that one is in rebellion, the knowledge that God is the righteous judge, and to one who is in rebellion, they will receive nothing but what the law says they deserve. To one who has that knowledge, their mind can only do one thing. Only one thing. Be moved by fear of what they deserve and try to find some way to annihilate that reason, or be moved by the hope that somehow they can do something to remove that condemnation. They live only under one of two motivations: the fear of their punishment or their hope of avoiding it. Listen carefully. In that frame of mind, to tell a person to love God in order to be saved, he cannot love God. Because to love God means disinterestedly. And when you tell a person who is in sin, who is facing the judgment of the law, he fears that judgment. He hopes to avoid it. If you tell him to love God in order to be saved, he will try to do what he thinks is loving God out of fear or out of hope, but he will not do it disinterestedly. He will not do it for its own sake. He will do it to avoid what he deserves. And therefore, it will not be love. You follow that? The only way The only way to prepare the heart, to have a heart that can truly be disinterested in its love, is to remove that hope and fear. And the only way to remove the hope and fear is God giving mercy and grace as a gift. Purely out of love to you or me. It is faith and confidence in the mercy of God and the grace of God. The degree of faith in His mercy and in His grace, to that degree, your mind is free of hope or fear. To the degree you have utter confidence that God will be merciful to you and gracious to you as a gift, to the degree you believe that promise, to that degree you are free from the hope and fear of the penalty of the law. Understand, do not misunderstand what we teach. We do not teach that if the sinner will love God, he will be saved. Because in a state of rebellion against God and under the law's condemnation, you cannot love God disinterestedly. You would only try to what you think would be love for God, but it would be to obtain something. And mercy and grace is given as a gift. Here it is, God says. Will you receive it? Now, when grace and mercy is received, mercy means that the penalty of the law to sins committed up to that time, are the penalty is forever set aside. Forever set aside. When the mind believes that truth, that the penalty of the law through pardon is forever set aside, why would you ever fear the penalty of the law? There's no reason to. Fear is gone. And only then is a person free to love God disinterestedly. Because there's nothing to gain out of it. There's no need to gain anything. It's already given. Hope and fear still exist in people's minds because they do not trust in the mercy and grace of God. People are unwilling to and unable to trust in the mercy of God in the sense I use it when they know that they have not really repented of their sin. When they know that they have not really forsaken their sin, not really confessed it open before God and before others and say, hey, I'm done with it. I'm done with it. When they do not believe that God sincerely, legitimately offers grace, offers mercy to the sinner. You know what the sinner, why he despairs? When he really begins to believe it's there. And he knows it's there. He knows it's there for the taking. And he knows the only thing keeping him back is his love of sin. Oh, what misery the sinner is in when he knows God will pardon him as soon as he forsakes his sin. What misery, what despair, knowing that the person's bondage to sin and their love for sin is the only thing between them and the mercy of God. A truly great reason for despair. People think they can't receive God's mercy because they're unworthy. No greater fact existed than that people are unworthy. And that's who mercy is for. That old idea, I'm unworthy, therefore I can't receive mercy, is the person who is still trying on the basis of law to be justified before God. So trying to prepare themselves to receive mercy. So trying to prepare themselves to commend themselves to God. And they will not confess to themselves that on the basis of law they've forever forfeited the claim to be justified by law. The only thing possible left, the only way possible left to have a relationship with God once law and its means has been forfeited is mercy. It's the only possible way. And that's exactly what the gospel reveals. This book is so profound, so beautiful. We get so little out of it compared to what I believe the Jews understood as Paul wrote it, with their depth of understanding of law, their confidence in it, and the impact of his statements upon them to destroy their self-righteousness. But by the Spirit of God, I believe, and that's where Paul will take us after this,